Rashad is tough for
going to be some readings on Friday.
It's
that
a very,
acceptable?
So it's a similar issue to the Megillah. Zachor, I would say if you have to choose one, either go for Zachor in person or go for Megillah in person. Not that it makes sense why it'd be one or the other. Zachor, I'd say you definitely want to hear in person because there we're dealing
but
with
what's
called a mitzvah d'oraisa, a biblical level obligation.
Does it matter if it's Friday or Saturday?
Well, ideally, it should be heard on Shabbos. That's when the idea behind Zachor, I mean, this is a whole separate shiur, but I'll just tell you briefly now since you're asking. The idea behind Zachor is that once a year we have an annual reminder to destroy Amalek. So on a rabbinical level, the rabbi said, you know what? The Shabbos before Purim is a great time to do that because Haman was a descendant of Amalek. So it fits thematically. But if one can't come to shul on Shabbos to hear it, that's why we're offering an option on Friday as well. So there'll be an 8 o'clock, 11 o'clock reading, if I recall correctly. And that'll be Zoomed. So it is possible also when we actually read the Parsha in the Parsha Sashavua much later on toward the end of the year, that'll be another way to fulfill it when you hear it in shul on that Shabbos, though. I'm not sure if you're going to remember to have in mind that you want to fulfill the mitzvah many parshios from now. So that's, but God willing, that'll be another shiur. I think Rabbi Cohen plans on addressing all these issues in his shiur. So again, I don't want to steal his thunder too much. But especially since I have a really, I think, fascinating topic tonight. I only try to pick fascinating topics. But I mean, I let all of you guys judge if that's true. But I want to talk about the halachic prenup made by the Rabbinical Council of America. Now, we just had 2 weeks. We had 2 weeks in a row, two sessions with Rabbi Shlomo Weissman of the Basin of America. It's not exactly the same as the RCA, but you know, it's like mostly all the same people, just different organizations. So the Basin of America made what's called the halachic prenup, which if you're a member of the Rabbinical Council of America, like myself, if I officiate a wedding, I am required to make the man and a woman getting married, they have to sign this prenuptial agreement made by the Rabbinical Council of America. So the goal is tonight, we're going to talk about what is the prenuptial agreement, what is the machlokus surrounding it? What's the dispute surrounding it? The prenuptial agreement I will talk about basically is to solve one main issue. The main issue is that in the Torah gives the power to a man to decide when he wants to divorce his wife. So, but it doesn't give a woman the power to divorce her husband. That's just in the Torah itself. That's biblical level right there. So as you can imagine, if it's the husband who wants to remove himself from that marriage, then there's no issue. He can remove himself from the marriage. Rabbeinu Gershon came along a good number of years later, and one of his gezeros, one of his enactments, was that a man can't just divorce his wife out of nowhere. She needs to consent to it. So sometimes there are issues where the woman is not consenting to the divorce, and so a man might need to get what's called a heter mei rabbanim. He gets 100 rabbis to sign on to annul and allow him to divorce his wife. But usually the issue, I mean, I don't have statistics, but at least in the media, as we see, the issue tends to run the other way, that many times the woman wants a divorce, but the husband will many times what they call being recalcitrant. He will hold back the get. He'll hold back the divorce document as sometimes out of pure spite, other times not necessarily out of spite, but as a means of leverage. For instance, let's say they're either in arbitration or, well, not arbitration, but they're going to court. So many times we have lawyers on with me, so you can tell me if you know otherwise. But when it comes to child custody, it seems that I'm not sure if it's strictly legal or just the sympathies tend to be that the judges would rather give more custody rights to the mother than to the father. And as you can imagine, if a father wants to spend more time with his children after a divorce, he doesn't have much going for him. So what he might do is he might try to strike a bargain with his divorced wife or soon to be divorced wife, saying, I will write you a get. I'll write you a halakhic divorce document, which halakhically enables you to marry someone else. In order so that you don't take as much money, alimony, or you give me more rights to custody of the children, whatever is the flashpoint that they're disputing over at the moment. So as one can imagine, on one hand, one could have sympathy. You know, if this person is never going to see his children, except for some holidays, you know, one might say that we feel bad for him and he should use whatever means he has. But on the other hand, many times it's not justified and it's used as it's weaponized against the woman. And therefore, the rabbis of the RCA and Basin of America, they came along and they needed to find a solution. So they created a prenuptial agreement. They created a prenuptial agreement that would basically the man signing in to this marriage will agree to certain terms which will compel him, so to speak, to give a get to his wife. Okay, just mute that. Perfect. Okay, so now I just want to make sure, you know, sometimes there's these discussions, there's so much introduction I need to give. I want to make sure, you know, sometimes I don't define things like what are gittin, what are divorce documents, how do they work? Is there anything just based on what I said now that seems a little bit unclear? Anything in the background of how Jewish divorce works from a halakhic standpoint and what the issue is that this prenuptial agreement comes to solve?
Again, can I just ask you, the woman cannot get a divorce whenever she wants, but a man can?
Right. So on the strict biblical level, it's within the man's power to divorce his wife, but not the woman's power to divorce her husband. Now, it happens to be one of the purposes of the ksuba, perhaps the main purpose, is that a man will not willy-nilly want to just divorce his wife the next time she burns his soup or ruins his soup, which is a case in the Gemara, by the way. I'm not just making that up. So because of that, the ksuba was made. So the ksuba, and those who've learned some of the Mishnayos with us, we learned that a ksuba is a huge, hefty amount of money that the husband needs to pay to his wife upon divorcing her. So there is a monetary disincentivization for him to divorce his wife. That also was likely some form of a rabbinic safeguard to discourage him from divorcing her. And putting her out on the street without anyone supporting her. But now the opposite issue is taking place, where not that we're trying to stop him from divorcing her, but we're actually trying to make sure that he divorces her. That way she doesn't go marry someone else and creates an adulterous union and has mamzerim from that marriage. So that's what we're trying to do over here. That's the main goal of the prenuptial agreement. Does that answer your question, Phyllis?
Yeah, but so it's always to protect the man, not the woman.
The prenuptial agreement?
Well, it sounds like the whole law, the system, is to protect the man more than the woman.
And that's precisely what this prenuptial agreement comes to address, is the fact that usually the power is solely in the hands of the man. So it comes along this prenuptial agreement and gives the woman some recourse so that she's not fully at his mercy. Does that make sense?
It does, but like in the absence of a Beit Din, and because this was a Torah law, how did they get around this?
Because the absence of a Beit, you're talking about the prenuptial agreement?
How did they get to that? Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. So that's why we have an entire shiur. Good. So I'm glad you're asking that question. The question, Dafka, is, remember those who are learning Makos with us, we learned a few weeks ago that if someone's Masna Masha Kosev Batorah, the Tanai is Batel. If the Torah says, remember those who are with us from Makos, the Torah says in the seventh year, old debts should be null, and I make a condition, I stipulate that the principle that Shemitah should not take effect on this business transaction. It doesn't matter. I can't stipulate something that goes against the Torah. So, right. So Phyllis is asking, wait, if I have a prenuptial agreement that says the man automatically has to divorce his wife, where's saying the Torah that he has to do that? And then furthermore, there's actually one of the issues that comes up, the central issue of forcing a man to give the get, is that there's something called a get meusa, a get, divorce document that's given under duress. If the man, if the husband is compelled against his will to divorce his wife, that is not a valid get. It has to be given by his own volition, by his own free will. Now, there is this Rambam out there, which I think some of you might be thinking about right now, who says that when we beat the guy, when based in, you know, I think in Lakewood, they actually did this. And there was like a whole sting operation and people got arrested. That's my recollection. So if Basin comes along and they say, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. And then they force the guy, they beat him until he says, Rotsa'ani, until he says, I'm willing to give the get. There is a Rambam that says it actually works, because deep down in his heart, he really wants to do what the Torah wants from him. And therefore, that's called being given by his own free will. You know, there's what to discuss about that. You know, if someone beat me until, you know, I agree to anything, is that called my own volition? Hard to say that, right?
There's a movie about that not recently, about a woman who wanted out.
Really?
I don't know the name of it, yeah.
A Jewish woman?
Yeah, I think it was from Israel.
It was an Israeli film, you know, based supposedly on a real story. A very good movie.
Yeah.
Don't you mean Unorthodox?
Yes, right. That's the one.
It's not a movie. It's
I remember here in Stanford, maybe about 10 years ago, Rabbi Cohen got involved in a get proceeding here in Stanford, whereby the man refused to give the wife a get, and she was prohibited from remarrying again, because that would be bigamy. And there was a demonstration in front of the man's apartment.
We had one. Rabbi Dratch did it. Rabbi Dratch did one.
Was it Dratch? Okay, I was wrong.
No. Rabbi Cohen was involved in one.
Oh, okay. Oh,
I
was wrong.
I remember him making announcements in Chill.
Okay, it was a different one.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, there's no shortage of these stories, so I wouldn't be surprised. and that's specifically what this document comes to address, is that it's such a common problem. And so something I want to point out is that this prenuptial agreement, so what they do actually is, when you go to ORA, it's called the Organization for Resolution of Agunos, and they're an advocacy organization. One of the main things they do is they promote this document written by the Beis Din of America, by Rabbi Shlomo Weissman. I don't think he was the author, it was really Rabbi Willig, who was the main architect of it. So, you know, it's a funny thing. You know, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, I don't know how much of you guys hold in the hack, you know, in yeshiva politics. But many times he lives in Riverdale, and he's known as like the really yeshivish guy in Riverdale, you know, because in Riverdale there's, you know, SAR, HIR, which is like more on the left of the modern Orthodox community. So, you know, he's usually, you know, people have said, oh, you know, he's anti-women and this, you know, people make up all sorts of claims. Meanwhile, he was one of the main people who went ahead, and he actually was the architect of this document, which was done solely for the purpose of helping these women. So, you know, just because he's not a feminist doesn't mean he's anti-women. That's a very important thing to note. So now this document is coming to solve this issue. Now, here's the thing. Why is it this isn't just like a more progressive innovation. This isn't like women rabbis. This has been accepted throughout the entire modern Orthodox community, basically. Mm-hmm. Everyone in YU promotes it. Rav Sevelovsky promotes it. Rav Schechter's on board, as far as I'm aware. Pretty much, at least no one is taking a stance against it in the
whole of YU. What about a Yisrael?
What was that? Good. So that's the question. So Toby says, what about the Agudas Yisrael? What about our friends and neighbors who live in the black and white Haredi world? How come this document hasn't been accepted there? And in case no one realized, even though we had a little bit of a hiatus, we are still in the middle of our Rav Moshe Sternbach series, which is why I would like to bring to you Rav Moshe Sternbach's tshuva against the RCA prenup. You know,
Can I add one thing?
By all means.
My daughter was married in Australia, Liba. The Orthodox rabbis will not perform the marriage unless there's a prenuptial agreement.
Mm-hmm.
I had one. Rabbi Gratz was very helpful to us with Liba's first marriage, which was in California, because the prenuptial agreement had to adhere to Jewish law as well as California law.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on what states. I didn't know that he was very, very helpful. She did get that, and she was married in Australia. She'll be 19 years. I'm just making it, want you to know that.
So Ruth, I'm glad you brought that up, because you are right. This document doesn't just operate on a halachic level. It comes to solve a halachic challenge, but it operates on a legal level as well. So as you can see, I'm sharing with you on the screen. It's also in the chat. I just want to familiarize ourselves with this document by the Based of America. You see, it says Based of America over here. Now, I was scrolling through the document. I want to show you something interesting. This was supported by many shuls. Our shul is on here. Can you see that?
Congregation
Agula Shalom in Stamford, Connecticut. So I was just looking through. So apparently there's different levels of sponsorship. So there's like the patrons, sponsors, and then the lowest is friends. So apparently, you know, we're supportive, but you know, we're not that full. No, I'm kidding. It's just like a monetary level.
Hey, we're better than Lincoln Square.
We're better than Lincoln Square. Right. Let's start comparing all our levels of donorship over here. We made it onto the second tier, everybody. So I don't know if that means like, you know, yeah, you know, we're kind of like with something, we weren't sure about the document completely. No, it doesn't
happen. No, I thought it was nice.
We have full confidence in this document. That's
Moshe?
Yes, Sadie.
I don't know about Connecticut, but it may apply in Connecticut as well. But in New York, we have a rule. I don't remember whether it was judge created or statutory, but they will not grant, the courts will not grant a divorce until it's proven to the court that both parties are religiously free to remarry.
Yeah, we don't have that in Connecticut.
So I think New York has been a little bit more amenable to executing and recognizing this document. I think if you actually go on the prenup website, there are certain things that New York is more leeway for. And I've heard that people who try to utilize and reap the benefits of this document in other states have had a more difficult time getting it recognized and executed by the courts there. But first of all, let's find out, what does this document actually do that solves the problem, right? This document, I want to be clear, you don't sign this document and then retroactively it annuls your marriage. There still needs to be a get given from the husband to the wife. That needs to take place. That is not on the table. That's sukkim in the Torah. That's not disputed. There still has to be some form of a sharkrisis that's given. Now, what are we doing exactly? So here's what's happening. And this is why we have to know about that a get given under duress is not a valid get. And I want to ask you, when we read these paragraphs here, does this look like it's compelling the husband under duress to give a get, or is he giving it by his own volition? Here we go. So just to familiarize yourselves with what the document looks like, Marissa and I signed this with Rabbi Eli Weissman of the Rabbi of Plainview. He's the one who did it for us before we got married and ran us through this. So if you look at Aura, you get these pictures that you take together and they put on their Facebook page. So you say, I signed the prenup because, and then you fill in the blank. So Marissa put in because women have rights or something like that. And I put in something more obtuse, saying because the Gedolim at YU support it. So I took the Das Torah approach. She took the Western approach. And apparently we both wound up in the same place anyway. So that was just
lucky you.
Yeah, if you scroll down our my Facebook's long enough and like enough.
Oh, I think I saw my cousin's posting when he got married. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like it's cute stuff. It's good promo for them. So here's the first part. Here's an arbitration agreement. Now, Rabbi Weissman talked about arbitration last week, so I think this is really great. We can apply our knowledge of what he talked about in general arbitration, I think in a more commercial setting, to what we're talking about over here in a marital setting. So this document, primarily the goal of it, is to make sure that the husband gives a get. Along the way, if you, you know, giving a get is just one part of the divorce process. Splitting the assets, the estates, and what's it called again? Visitations, who the children are going to be with, all these different messy things that have to be sorted out. You have an option also to go to the Base of America for arbitration. So that's what these lines over here are for, so that you can opt to go to them for arbitration. Now, I want to point out an important line over here. We're not going through this entire thing together, but the language, there's certain language here, which is important from a halakhic standpoint. Ah, here it is. Let me see if I could zoom in a little bit so we don't need to lose eyesight in the process. That look good? We can see the words over here, this paragraph?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now I just need to get rid of all of your faces on the right side so I can read myself. okay, Zoom hasn't worked everything out for me yet. Here we go. I obligate myself to support my wife-to-be, this is done before marriage, it's a prenup, according to the requirements of Jewish law governing Jewish husbands. Great, I accept halakha. Furthermore, I hereby now, may achshav, this is a halakhic point here, I obligate myself at this moment in a manner that I cannot exempt myself with any claim of ismachta, unenforceable conditional obligation, or any other claim. Now, who remembers what ismachta is? Ismachta, we talked about Hanukkah time. Remember we talked about, is it mutter to gamble? Is it mutter to play dreidel and gamble? So what was one of the issues? Ismachta, that when I gamble, you know, when you and I make a business deal, I buy a book from you. So I have gemir das. I want to buy that book from you. But when I place a bet, we bet on the Super Bowl, whoever watched it, right? We bet on the Super Bowl. And I don't need, who played in it? There was like a pirate team and something else. And I'm even saying this because I'm from, I just like, I was like, you know, like watching Lord of the Rings or something else at the same time. You know, just, that's not what I do as a pastime. But anyway, okay, right, so.
Indian team.
All right, there's an Indian team and a pirate team. Very great.
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. So if I vote, if I bet on the, I don't even know who won?
Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And I only had it on as background noise.
Okay. So so the Buccaneers win. So when I placed a bet on the Indian team and the Indian team did not win, I did my research and I thought the Indians were going to win. But then they did not win. So when I begrudgingly have to pay you the money because I lost the bet, there's a little taste, a little remnant of gezel, of theft, because I don't really want to give you that money. I don't have full gemir das. I thought I was going to win. So it's possible, since I did not know for sure I was going to lose, there's not full consent. There isn't full gemir das when I give you the money. So one of the major issues that Rav Moshe Sternbach alludes to in his tshuva, we'll see inside, God willing, is that when you agree to the terms that you will have to pay your wife, which we'll see in a moment, a kind of a knas, a penalty payment of sorts, when you don't divorce her, that could be possibly an ismachta. So therefore, that's why in the document here it says, I'm fully aware of the issue of ismachta, but I know that there's a good chance I might have to pay her, and I'm accepting that nonetheless. So let's continue in the wording here. So I accept upon myself, no issues of ismachta, to support my wife-to-be from the date that our domestic residence together shall cease, for whatever reasons, at the rate of $150 per day. Okay, there's a lot of details, by the way, thrown into this. So, number one, when does he start paying? From the point that domestic residence ceases. Not when she first goes to court, but when they separate, if he doesn't divorce her or doesn't agree to divorce her, then he starts paying $150 a day, calculated based on you know, shifting values as published by the U.S. Department of Labor Bureau of Labor Statistics. So it's $150 a day in lieu of my Jewish law obligation of support. Now, where does this $150 come from?
Yeah.
Anyone know? So it's not just an partially arbitrary, but it's not based on, it's not
from the ketubah.
Ah, very good. Who said that?
Susan,
very good. It's based on the ketubah. So in the ketubah, in a marital agreement, the man, the husband, has obligations to his wife. The wife has obligations to her husband. The husband has to provide shir ksusva ona. He has to provide sustenance. He has to provide a house for his wife to live in. And in return, his wife gives him his maisa yadayim, gives him her wages in order to support the household or whatever she brings in. So what's going on? Once he is no longer living with his wife and no longer supporting her, he still has an obligation until he divorces her. So long as he has not paid the ksuba, he hasn't divorced her, and he hasn't paid her the ksuba, he still has an obligation, like any other husband, to provide a house for her to live in and provide sustenance for her. And if he's not living with her and not bringing groceries in the door for her to eat, well, at least he should give her enough money that she should be able to live on her own with a house, a roof over her head, and with food as well to sustain her. So don't ask me how they figured this out, but they figured $150 a day. Someone do the math. It's like 50 something thousand dollars a year. That would be enough to sustain a person to have somewhere to live as well as enough to eat every day. Now, even though this is operating off the basic suba, it actually serves as a penalty. Now, how is it a penalty? You might ask, wait a minute. If the man still needs to support his wife, even when they are separated until the point that he divorces her, doesn't she then still have to reciprocate and then give him her wages? Right?
So what if she doesn't work?
What was that, Audrey?
What if she doesn't work? She's home taking care of the family.
Okay, that's a good point. Though many stay-at-home mothers, they still might have some sort of side job. So in that case, what would you do if she's bringing in some kind of money? Shouldn't that go to the husband then? So that's what the next line comes to tell us. As in here and above, cited and circumscribed, so long as the two of us remain married according to Jewish law, even if she has another source of income or earnings. Furthermore, here it is. I waive my halachic rights to my wife's earnings for the period that she is entitled to the above stipulated sum. And I recite that I shall be deemed to have repeated this waiver at the time of our wedding. I acknowledge I have now, me'ashav, affected the above obligation by means of a kinyan in an esteemed based in and prescribed as prescribed by Jewish law. So here's the important line. I waive my halachic rights to my wife's earnings.
Yeah.
So very simple.
It wouldn't be deducted from the $150 a day that he's supposed to pay.
He has to give full $150 a day. And now how do we make sure
he's
actually getting $150 is not deducted? Because then all he does is simply say, I waive my rights to my wife's finance.
What if he's lost his job or something?
If he loses his job, you're saying, like, let's say he just runs out of money completely?
Yeah, I guess.
He'll owe her money still, you know, even once he has money.
Accidentally on purpose.
Yeah, but what about if he's really wealthy and this amount of money means nothing to him?
Yeah,
that doesn't end up getting her divorced.
That's always a question I had. Yeah, it's...
Because somebody could be suddenly wealthy, you know, invent something weird, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely not another way.
But this instrument.
Now, I have a question before we have the divorce. When you get married, does the wife's money go to the man? Which sounds like what the
agreement.
Yeah, the agreement has.
So the way it works is that maybe from a strict halakhic standpoint, she does owe certain things to the husband, but I would hope that most, Most couples going into a healthy relationship, a healthy marriage, aren't operating in terms of strict legal requirements and entitlements. Hopefully, I mean, you know, it's like Marissa and I, we have a shared bank account. You know, we're in for the long haul. That's our goal. So, that, you know, if your aim is to be in it for the long haul, then I would imagine that the husband's not like, all right, pay up, give me all the money. Here's your food for the week. You know,
that's right.
So
you never know.
Did you say that the husband's obligation is a penalty?
Ah, okay. Very good. Very good. So
the reason I'm asking is, again, I don't know Connecticut law, but in New York, a penalty, contract penalty, is unenforceable.
Very good. So, two things.
And your agreement was made in New York.
Right. Okay. That's true also. Yeah, you got to be there.
So, then the question is, does New York law apply when you're in Connecticut?
Connecticut, right.
Made in New York.
That's a good question.
Where do you have to get the divorce? Do you have to get the divorce in New York or in Connecticut?
Well, the halachic or the legal? Where you're living, the marital state is called the marital race. It's like an object. It goes with the couple.
The territory.
Right. I guess if you...
Where the marriage lives. If the marriage lived in Connecticut, you get divorced in Connecticut, even if the marriage was in New York.
Interesting.
Well, okay. You would get divorced in Connecticut. I don't think New York would take the divorce case. But the question becomes is, if it's an unenforceable penalty in New York, does it become enforceable in Connecticut but it's not considered a penalty? Or Connecticut enforces penalties?
Okay, so that's a great question.
By the way, I guess if you move to Israel, all bets are off, huh?
very common. Well, actually, I would say in Israel, the for better or for worse, the Rabbanut actually deals with these issues. And there's stronger sanctions against get refusers in Israel than America.
Really?
I mean, I don't know all the details. I mean, many people complain that this is
helpful
enough. But whereas in America, who's dealing with this issue? The Beis Din of America and trying to get the legal system to recognize these documents. Whereas in Israel, you have formal governmental bodies which have power that are pursuing the plight of Agunos. So,
yeah.
I mean, again, you could argue how much they're actually trying. Can they be doing better? Beyond my pay grade to comment on that.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that you have somewhere inherently within the governmental body where they're interested in dealing with it. Whereas in America, it's not on their radar.
Right.
So we're trying to put it on their radar. That's the difference. So back to my grandfather's point about penalties. Again, beyond my pay grade to comment on the American legal aspects to it. I know very, very rudimentary amount. I'm sure yourself and all the other lawyers on here can better comment. But from a halachic perspective, there's a big issue if we look at this as a penalty. So if anyone is looking, I'm not going to screen share it really, but if you're looking in the tshuva, so I put the prenup PDF in the tshuva, which is what we just in the chat. And I also put the Tshuvos Vanhagos, I put our tshuva from Rav Moshe Sternbach in the chat as well. So Rav Moshe Sternbach, if you're following along, it's on the second page. I'm just on the wrong page and I have the sefer in front of me. That's the issue. And I'm on the wrong page in here. Let's see. One moment. Here it is. Okay. So the title is Heskem Kodem Nisulim Noa Igun HaIsha. So number one, if you look in the tshuva on the second line already, he calls them out by name. Histadrus HaRabbanim Ba'artus HaBris. That's the Hebrew for the Rabbinical Council of America. So he's not like, you know, in a backward way addressing it. He calls out the RCA by name. That's number one. So we all know what he's talking about here. He's not mincing words. And of course, in Rav Moshe Sternbach fashion. So he says, on the one hand, if someone wants to accept, here's a way to get someone out. Before the prenup existed, a man could accept upon himself a knas. He'll say that if I don't give my wife a get, then for every day I don't give her a get, I have to pay X amount of money. So the question is that valid? So he quotes the Ramah passing for Ashkenazi Jewry, and the Shulchan Aruch writes, Dim kiva lav knasos im lo yigarish, lo mikriones, me'achet etolah gito v'davar acher. He says, b'di'eved, ex post facto, if someone accepts a knas on themselves, a penalty on themselves, saying that as long as I don't pay my wife, I owe her money as a penalty. So I'm not being forced to give the get, but it happens to be the way of alleviating this knas, this penalty that I've imposed upon myself. I need to give a get because that would free me from that knas. So no one's pushing me to give the get. I freely accepted a knas upon myself. And the way to alleviate that knas happens to be by issuing a get to the wife. So is that valid or is it still considered get me'usa, to be given under duress? So the Ramah says, ex post facto, it's okay, but definitely not something you want to build a system on. However, this is the important line over here. The Toras Gittin makes the point that when we're talking about something similar to our prenuptial agreement, here, the whole beauty of the prenuptial agreement is that it doesn't operate off an external knas. It doesn't, I mean, just forget about what your opinions on the document or political purposes, just from a strict halachic standpoint, it's beautiful. There's no external penalty being imposed. He's not saying, I accept a penalty of $150 on myself for every day I don't give a get to my wife. He's simply saying, I will continue to fulfill my obligation that's written in the ksuba of supporting my wife every day. Now, the way I used to fulfill that obligation was when she was living in the same house as me. So I didn't have to be literally $150. That's just an assessment. But by me getting the groceries, by me making sure that the rent check is paid for, that is a fulfillment of my obligations to my wife as written in the ksuba. So for every day that the man and wife are separated and he has to pay $150, that's not a new hischayvus. That's not a new monetary obligation that I accept upon myself as a penalty in the event I don't want to give a get, but rather that's just a continuation of an obligation of the ksuba that was already in place. What am I doing? So now what? Then what's the big deal? We're following the ksuba. Why do I need a prenuptial agreement? All the prenuptial agreement is doing is saying that I waive my wife's obligations to me. I waive my entitlement to my wife's wages, but I'm not touching the obligation that I had since the beginning of my marriage as stipulated in the ksuba for many years. So the beauty of this is that it circumvents, supposedly, the issue of knas altogether. There's no penalty that's putting me under duress, that is forcing me into a situation, backing me up into a corner where I need to give the get. There's no knas. Rather, I'm just paying her what I owe her for being her husband. I don't want to be her husband anymore and have to pay this. Very simple. I just give a get. Then the ksuba is paid off. It's no longer binding on me. So there you go. That's the suggestion given by the Toras Gittin. And that's the rationale that we just saw in the prenuptial agreement document, that the $150 is being paid as part of the ksuba, and he waives his entitlement to his wife. Okay. What do we make of that? Do you think that solves the issue of knas? Does that solve the issue of a get me'usa?
I think if we don't call it a penalty and we call it a liquidation of the measurement of what it costs for her to be supported the way she was being supported when they lived together, that is just a measurement of his continuing support obligation because they're still married. So we call it that they've defined what his support obligation is in dollars and cents. Don't call it a penalty, not in New York.
Exactly. Precisely what you're saying. And not only, it's not just a matter of PR. It's not just a matter of, you know, marketing and branding. From a strict halakhic standpoint, it's not a knas. It's not a penalty. Now, again, I don't know practically what that looks like in court, from what I hear in New York, it's enforceable. That's the word I was looking for before.
I would say it is. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Because I mean, I'm saying that right. And I'm saying not just theoretically.
You're measuring a support obligation. You're not imposing a penalty.
Great. So that's why the logic here is why it doesn't work that's why it works from a halakhic perspective. And again, however they worked it out, maybe what you're suggesting in New York is why it's enforceable in a court in New York as well. So that is Ramosha Sternbach's framework that he explains is the rationale behind the prenuptial agreement. However, if you look on page, those who are following inside, on page Taf Lamed Beis, after giving us a very, what I consider a compelling argument for the prenuptial agreement, he writes in the underline I put over there in the first column, Taf Lamed Beis, Aval Emes, Shishtar, Heskin, Nesuin, Zeh, this prenuptial agreement, Hu Chorbon Hadas Mamish. It's a destruction of our religion. Umashilim B'chashash Isser Eishes Ish. It creates a possible, what it does is it allows someone who could still quite possibly have not been given a get under the right circumstances, meaning it's possible this document, even after all that we said, might not work. And so we have a suffix ashes ish, a woman who still might be considered halakhically married, going ahead and marrying another man, having adultery with him, and producing mamzer and producing basically children who will not be able to marry other Jews. Now,
that's why in New York, you're not going to be able to get a legal divorce until you have a religious divorce.
I look at it. Oh, interesting, because everything needs to be taken care of.
She's got a new marriage and she's stuck.
Right. So there can't be anything that's holding them still together. That's
wonder how do they enforce something like that, being religion is...
Zay.
The court will not grant a civil divorce until it's established by, I don't practice divorce law, but I know this, that until it's established to the court's satisfaction, it might be just by affidavits, that both parties are religiously free to remarry, either because they have no religion or because they've met the requirements of their religion, be it the Catholic Church, which would be an annulment, I understand, or the Jewish religion, where a get is given, then the state Supreme Court, which is our general jurisdiction court, the Court of Appeals is the highest court, then the Supreme Court will go ahead and grant a judgment of divorce.
Annulments are very hard to get, or at least they're a little easier now, but boy, that's a tough nut.
All right. Well, so I guess, definitely I'm glad that we have some legal advice over here. Oh, Toby, you're muted. I see your mouth moving.
Unmute.
I don't think that there are too many. I mean, I don't know. I don't know that I've ever heard of Christians who made that an issue in terms. I mean, all they have to do is say, we're irreligious. Doesn't matter to us. I've never heard of that being an issue in a non-Jewish situation.
Right. I would think, especially in New York, which is very liberal when it comes to these things, just say you're not religious and exactly. There you go. Okay, so that's very interesting to consider.
So both of them would have to say they're non-religious if they're Jews.
Yeah, not that hard to say. Okay, so now just a few points for Moshe Sternbach. Why does he consider this a Chorban Hadas Mamish? So one is something that we brought up already, which is the issue of Esmachta. He doesn't say it explicitly, but he says if someone accepts an obligation, takes a shvuah upon himself, and there's a chance that he might regret it later on, if he regrets it, it's possible that the condition never took place. So that's one concern that he brings up based on the Shudmar Shtam. The other consideration really comes down to is that this might not be from a mechanical technical, legalistic perspective, a knas when you work it out the way we just explained, but it's certainly, even if, this is like the opposite, usually like, when you're from a more, traditional approach, you many times will block certain things based on based on halakhic details and nuances and legal formalism. And many times it's us from the non-Orthodox community who try to say, forget the legal formalism. I have an overriding ethical concern. We should ignore it. We should ignore that. So here it kind of gets flipped. So the reasoning, those who are following inside, if you're looking on Tuf Lamed Gimel, the reasoning of the prenuptial agreement is as follows. We're not worried that the man is going to regret or didn't honestly mean to, he honestly didn't mean to waive his rights to his wife's wages. This all assumes that he actually legitimately waived his wife's wages. But maybe in his heart of hearts, he really wasn't waiving his entitlements to her wages. So what happens then? You know, maybe he just wants to get married, and all the rabbis nearby were YU rabbis, and they said we had to do a prenup. He's like, okay, I'll sign a prenup. I'm signing. I don't know what a ksuba is either, but I'm signing a ksuba. I don't know what tanayim are, right? I don't know what any of these things are, but I'm gonna, you know, put my law. I'm gonna sign on. I'm gonna agree to the terms of whatever stipulated in there. So the same way, I don't read the ksuba carefully. I don't read the prenup carefully. It's just another document the rabbi's making me sign. So, but maybe he didn't really mean to. He didn't really mean to waive his entitlement to his wife's wages. So it doesn't matter, Torah Skidin says, and those who promote the prenup, because we look at your words. It's kind of like in Nedarim also to a certain extent, that if I said I am waiving my rights, I signed on the dotted line, I waive my rights to my wife's wages, and I still have to pay her my obligations to her, then that's it. We only look at what you said. We don't look at what you were thinking. However, Rav Moshe Shtermak's argument is El Kol Shalibov Libam Yodin Belo Amir Shekavanasim La Onso Bashil Ikov Agershin Harezek Moshe Onso Nosokadisha Igar Shavi Gemma. He says that this is still considered a Gemma Usa. It's a get given under duress because for whatever reasons he had to sign this. You know, maybe it was certain pressure, social pressures. It was pressure from the rabbi or whatever it was. So it's possible that there isn't a full Gemiras Das, that he didn't truthfully mean to waive his rights. I mean, there are many people, admittedly, even myself at the time, you know, again, I don't want to cast aspersions on the prenup. If I didn't say it yet, I'll say it now. I support the prenuptial agreement. You can quote me on that. It's on recording now. Great. Now, again, but again, not from an advocacy standpoint, but from an educational standpoint. So I'll be honest with you. When I first signed the prenup, I had not looked into the sugya, and I didn't fully understand the halachic mechanisms at play. I did not understand the $150 from Iksuba, and I'm waiving my rights to my wife's wages. I didn't realize those nuances were in there. Kal v'chomer, I mean, again, I'm not the biggest Talmud Chacham, but I'm sure
but you
there
signed
are many people.
But you signed it. But you signed it.
Oh, but exactly. That's the argument.
They wouldn't have married him.
So according to the promoters of the prenup, I signed it. That's all we look at. Yeah. But according to Moshe Shtermak, even if I signed it, but I didn't mean it, it casts aspersions on the legitimacy of the document. So therefore, Moshe Shtermak takes opposition to it. There's a number of other things in the Tshuva to look into. And again, I provided for your reading. But again, this is part of the reason that it hasn't been as easily accepted in the Haredi community. I mean, there's really two reasons. One, halachically, it's a little dubious, according to posting like Rav Moshe Shtermak. And number two, this goes back to the question that I asked Rabbi Shlomo Weissman at the end of his first Scholar in Residence session with us. So for those who weren't with us, or, you know, I doubt anyone was paying that much attention to what I was saying, but what I asked him was, the same people who are promoting the prenuptial agreement, right? Take someone like Rabbi Willick, the architect of it. The same people who are promoting this prenuptial agreement are also people who are taking hardline stances against other innovations, such as women's ordination. So I asked him as follows. I said, and you know, actually, if you look, what are the organizations that are most ardently supporting Ora's prenup? That are supporting the
RCA.
Prenup? RCA, but you also see many organizations like JOFA. Oh, yeah. You'll see many organizations which are explicitly feminist organizations. So what I was trying to ask him, I didn't explicate it because I didn't want to be confrontational. But what I was trying to ask is, what makes the prenuptial agreement a more legitimate innovation than women's ordination? Because think about it. What I have here is an issue that there's a lack of equity for women, that the power of divorce is fully in the hands of a man, of the husband, and the woman has nothing really helping her. So what do? We create a prenuptial agreement to help the woman in a case of divorce. So what you have here is something that is not in the Torah, but a legal loophole put together in order to help a woman in a way that she wouldn't have had power otherwise. I mean, so why should that be any different than when it comes to women's ordination, let's say, or it comes to any other innovation that we want to make? So too over there. I have women who, it's obviously not as desperate, you know, again, someone wanting to be a rabbi isn't as desperate of a case as a woman who's not able to remarry. But if I'm a woman and I want to become a rabbi, and so some opinions, remember, we learned this in a shiur a good number of weeks ago. Some opinions will say a woman can't have a position of authority, that's srara. But there are opinions that say there's no issue. You can accept a woman rabbi to judge your cases if you want that. That's what we learned together. So I have halachic backing, not full halachic backing, but like this prenup. There's not a consensus. There's reason to doubt it, but there's good reason to say that it works also. And then comes along, and then when it comes to women rabbis also, there's reason to say that a woman can't be a rabbi, and there's halachic reason to say that a woman could become a rabbi in the community. So why over there is that an innovation that we all of a sudden say that's feminist, it's external values from the Torah, and therefore we're not going to accept such an innovation? Now, Toby.
Oh. I'm ignoring that.
We got a musical accompaniment.
No, I think, I mean, to me, what comes across as a big difference is that in the get situation, all you need essentially is it's a contract between two people. It's mm-hmm. an interpersonal agreement where both parties agree. And so they sign this and it becomes effectuated. With ordination, it goes beyond the agreement of any two people. You know, you make
point.
It's very different to me. It's a whole communal thing. It involves, you know, God. It involves it's way beyond the scope of, you know.
So I hear your distinction that when we zoom,
not very articulate. I'm sorry, but you get what I'm getting at.
I think I get it, and I get it. I want to explain it just to make sure I understand and then disagree with it, assuming I understand correctly. It's true that this is an agreement between two individuals, but keep in mind, the prenuptial agreement of the RCA is not something that we're just saying, hey, you know, there's a document out there, there's a resource. If you want to do it, do it. If don't, it's all chill, whatever. No, what we're saying is we are not, again, someone like myself, Rabbi Cohen, we are not allowed to perform a marriage without a prenuptial agreement. We can't do it. We're creating a community standard where you don't get married without a prenuptial agreement. This is a communal level innovation. Now, every time a document is signed, yes, technically it's just between the man and the woman, but this is a communal standard that is being propounded within the modern Orthodox community and some places even beyond that. So I would say it actually is analogous to a certain degree to a woman's ordination issue, where that's also something that would impact the community as a whole as well. And I think really what the question it comes back to is that when are we willing to, you know, again, Rabbi Weissman's answer, I think, was good as a framework. He says, when do we make innovations? When the intentions are based on Torah values, and if it could work halachically from a halachic mechanical legal perspective, legal standpoint.
Well,
he's got both those conditions. So
this was done in by a woman judge in the Jewish nation. She ruled on halacha.
Right, right. That was our whole shiur.
And on the other hand, when you make an innovation that creates additional obligations on the husband in a divorce situation over and above the get, it can be argued that Hashem defined the husband's obligations, mm-hmm. and his obligations are on the get as prescribed in the Torah. And you're challenging Hashem's judgment as to what a husband's obligations are, by innovating something new.
Very good. Excellent. So, right. Thank you for articulating that. So I think if I understood correctly, what my grandfather is saying is that one could say that the document is problematic because if Hashem desired, again, you know, we don't understand his ways, but, you know, the same God who said a Kohen can't marry a divorced woman also, we don't fully understand that. So, you know, if God wanted the woman to be able to get herself divorced whenever she wants, why didn't God just put it into her hands to be able to do that when she wanted to? So one, if one has very traditional sensitivities, they might say God deliberately put the power in the hands of the man to choose when to divorce, when not to divorce. So one could argue, who are we to come along and make such an innovation to the Torah? If Hashem really wanted the man or the woman actually to get a divorce whenever she wants to, why didn't Hashem just do that to begin with instead of having to make us come up with this prenuptial agreement? Now, again, I mean, it's a similar thing that we do in Mechiras Chametz also, selling Chametz, that we found a legal loophole in order to get around what is a major issue. But the point I just want for food for thought is I want to go back, Toby, to what you said when we learned about the woman's ordination topic and conclude with this. So what we learned in the woman's ordination issue is that the issue of a woman being a rabbi, the main issue is not about a woman being a rabbi, it's about a woman having a position of authority in the community. So that's why the Young Israel umbrella organization in their charter document, whatever it's called, their constitution, they don't permit women to serve as presidents of their shuls either. And so what I said was, well, if you're okay with a woman being a president, because it's not an issue of her having authority over the congregation, you circumvent that issue, then in theory, a woman could also be a rabbi as well. Because if the issue is authority, then if she could be a president, she could be a rabbi too. So what Toby, what your point, remember, was that we just want consistency. I mean, I'm not saying we're not talking about actual good Shalom policy. That's beyond my pay grade to determine. but the point is, we want consistency. So if are you all in or are you all out? You know, you got to figure out what your values are and then figure out what the implications and consequences of those values are. So if one is willing to say, I'm okay with an innovation of a prenuptial document in order to benefit the women who it's serving, then why would I not support other innovations which could have halachic backing, but calling those feminist or outside external values? How do we make these determinations? So do we rely, I mean, again, one way is to just rely on Das Torah, to rely on people like Rabbi William Herschel Schachter to have the intuition to do that. But we should really ask ourselves that question. Are we being consistent when we allow some innovations that have halachic backing, not others that have halachic backing, simply by saying some are done with good intentions and some are not done with good intentions? That's a tough question to answer. I can't fully answer that myself, but I bring these sources again to your attention. That way it could create conversation and we can have source-based discourse. And I look forward to talking about it more with people off the session, but we're at 9 o'clock. So I would like to conclude and wish everybody a good night.
Rabbi, I just want to mention Rabbi Emanuel Rackman of Shara Tefillah, when it was still in Far Rockaway, was a very, very staunch fighter for the Agunot.
Really?
And when he retired, he gave his full time to doing that. Yes, yes.
Wow.
He was a rabbi in Shara Tefillah for many years. I don't remember the exact. It was definitely during the 50s and 60s.
Oh, so much before Rabbi Wurzberger, yeah. Much before.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. And the Haredi community is very against the Beit Din.
Beast of America. American.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Rabbi,
yeah.
I don't know if you brought this up. Hi. But the tikkun of Rabbi Gershom, how would you characterize that in terms of what you just said?
So,
of a tikkun.
Right. So yeah, Rabbeinu Gershom came along was to deal with the opposite case. You see here, the woman wants to be divorced, but the husband's not giving her a divorce document. Rabbeinu Gershom came to solve the opposite issue, which is the woman doesn't have her own career, doesn't have her own income, classic household, traditional household, and she's afraid of being thrown on the street without any financial support or a roof over her head. So what Rabbeinu Gershom instituted was that a husband cannot divorce his wife unilaterally without her consent. That way, he can't just throw her out on the street, take her
ksuba. Correct.
So that's
but isn't that motivation really a public policy motivation rather than a strictly Torah motivation?
Interesting. You're saying the same question I'm raising for prenuptial agreement, in theory, could be imposed on Rabino Gershom. Very good. So I think, so okay, that's one of the answers when I asked Rav Sobolovsky about this. Why and why you? You know, like more yeshiva, Rosh Yeshiva, they're okay with this document. He said, you look, there's a lot of halakhic precedents, Rabino Gershom, and there's a lot, even a ksuba in general is an innovation that's done for the welfare of the woman herself. So we have a long tradition of certain tikkunim, certain gezeros being made, certain takanos, certain gezeros being made for the benefit of the woman. So since this isn't something new, this is just a new manifestation, something that's been going on from generation to generation, we're not concerned that's being motivated by third wave feminism or progressivism, but it seems to be something that is intrinsic to halacha since almost its inception. So I think that speaks to your point. But whereas the female clergy part, you know, that becomes a great dispute. You know, some people, like my grandfather just said, will turn to Devorah as precedent. And we saw in the Rishonim that they do that as well. So the question is that, you know, it could be both. You know, you could have precedent in the Torah, but you could still be overall motivated by a non-Torah ideology. And the question is, what do we do when there's a mix? It's almost like, again, I don't want to editorialize that much, but I talked to a woman who was in GPADS and she was telling me about her experience. GPADS is the graduate program for Gemara studies at Stern College. So it's not smicha, but women get to study in graduate school. They're studying Gemara to become, many times it's a gap year, or they're becoming Jewish educators. Some of them go on to become Yotzot Halacha. So she was telling me about the funding for the GPADS program. She said there are some people who just say, we want a program where women can learn more Torah. Some people, they see it as a gateway for eventually setting up the stage for women to become full rabbis and for a realization of feminist values. So many times it's not black and white. Many times you'll have people with different motivations. Sometimes you have one person with two motivations in their mind. You know, we're not all simple beings. So that's really one of the challenges here nowadays. Okay. I think we
excellent. Thank you.
All right. Yasher Koach, everyone. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you so much.